Hi, this is The Takeaway for Wednesday, January 31st, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Glad to have you with us on this Wednesday. On Tuesday night, President Donald Trump delivered his first State of the Union address to a joint session of Congress. Outside of the Washington, D.C. bubble, there was a nation listening as well. And today we want to give you the chance to speak. Tell us about the state of your union.
My name is Billy Taylor, and I'm calling from Greenville, South Carolina.
This is Kelly from Lizetta.
My name's Andrea, and I'm calling from Portland, Oregon.
This is Nancy from Silverdale, Pennsylvania.
This is Laura calling from Peoria, Illinois.
The state of my union
is looking pretty bleak.
It's better than ever.
Afraid.
As one of a renewed spirit to speak truth to power.
This is Evelyn from Pensauken. The state of my union is demanding. Demanding and getting me to be a more engaged and active citizen. I watch and read news from several and different sources, purposely including a few that I don't agree with.
It's Kevin Loney. Very optimistic. Customers are ecstatic. They're buying stuff. We're making money. And I'm very proud that we're finally standing up for America.
Your voices from all across America on the state of your union. I'm joined now by Jean Guerrero, Fronteras reporter with KPBS in San Diego, California. Hi, Jean.
Hi, great to be here.
Also here is Adrian Ma, who covers business and the economy for WCPN Live Idea Stream in Cleveland, Ohio. Adrian, hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And back with us, Michael Pope, reporter for Virginia Public Radio. Michael, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Jean Guerrero from KPBS in San Diego, I want to start with you. And let's talk about immigration, because the president spent quite a bit of space in his speech on immigration last night.
Tonight, I am calling on Congress to finally close the deadly loopholes that have allowed MS-13 and other criminal gangs to break into our country. We have proposed new legislation that will fix our immigration laws and support our ICE and Border Patrol agents. These are great people. These are great, great people that works so hard in the midst of such danger.
Gene, Congress is going to see if they can find a deal on DACA recipients, the border wall, border security, things like that. But the specter of MS-13, the president spent a lot of time last night, as he did in the campaign, presenting undocumented immigrants as a direct threat to the health and safety of Americans. How does it play where you're from?
So a lot of the people who I spoke with after the State of the Union were talking about how, while the speech was very temperate in tone overall in regards to immigration, they really didn't get the sense that that was the case because of what you're talking about, these repeated mentions of MS-13, which in the eyes of many people at the border sort of equate illegal immigration with criminality, with gang violence. So there was the sense that while the president did reiterate his commitment to the Dreamers, to finding a pathway for citizenship for 1.8 million of these people who came here when they were young, that overall the tone of the speech when it came to immigration was still rather divisive, specifically having the family whose daughters were victims of MS-13. People were pretty upset and alarmed at the fear that that might cause in a lot of people who were watching the State of the Union and just creating greater alarm when it comes to illegal immigration.
Well, we'll talk a little bit more about immigration and potentially a coming deal. Adrian Ma, let me turn to you from WCPN in Cleveland, Ohio, ground zero of the economy. The president last night touting his tax cuts and the strength of the American economy. Listen.
The great news for Americans, 401k, retirement pension, and college savings accounts have gone through the roof. And just as I promised the American people from this podium 11 months ago, we enacted the biggest tax cuts and reforms in American history.
Adrian, are the Americans who live in and around Cleveland and there in Ohio feeling all the juice in the economy that the president was talking about?
Well, first of all, that statement about this being the largest tax cut in American history, it's just not true. I've talked to tax preparers who are sort of trying to make sense of the new overhaul, and they said, yeah, this is big, but it doesn't compare to the tax cuts that were made during the Reagan era. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that, to a certain extent, yes, some people in Ohio are starting to feel a little bit of trickle. There's a company, Fifth Third Bank, in Cincinnati is one of those companies that came out after the tax cuts passed and said they were going to start issuing bonuses and raises to some employees. Overall, I think businesses are happy that their rates will come down. That goes for corporations and smaller pass-through companies. But I'm also told that small businesses are still trying to make sense of what the new tax code makes for them. So small businesses still digesting the cuts, but at least tax preparers will have a lot more work for them.
And Adrian, listen to the president here talking about one of his favorite topics when it comes to the economy, the stock market.
Small business confidence is at an all-time high. The stock market has smashed one record after another, gaining $8 trillion and more in value in just this short period of time.
Record stocks on Wall Street, Adrian Mata. Do middle-class workers in Canton, Ohio or Cleveland celebrate that?
Well, he's right that the stock market has been hitting new highs. And even though the stock market is not the economy, he's also correct that the economy has added more jobs since he got into office. And he kind of made a point of saying that 200,000 new manufacturing jobs have also been added. And that is sort of being felt in our state. Manufacturing jobs have ticked up about 1.5% over the past year. I will object to one thing he said. He said that there's sort of a surge in auto employment. Auto parts manufacturing is a huge thing in our state. We're not seeing a surge in auto employment. The numbers don't bear that out. And at least one analyst I spoke to is actually predicting a slowdown in auto sales, which could have a negative impact on that industry.
Well, Michael Pope, you have your ear to the ground, as you always do there in Virginia. But this time on healthcare, premiums are on the way up in Virginia. They're on the way up in every healthcare market across America and have been for decades. Listen to the president celebrating the one piece of Affordable Care Act repeal that Congress did manage, the individual mandate.
We eliminated an especially cruel tax that fell mostly on Americans making less than $50,000 a year, forcing them to pay tremendous penalties simply because they couldn't afford government-ordered health plans. We repealed the core of the disastrous Obamacare. The individual mandate is now gone. Thank
you. Michael Pope, in purple Virginia, are Virginians in the Commonwealth celebrating the end of the individual mandate?
Well, some of them are and some of them are not. You know, perhaps unsurprisingly, the reaction to the Affordable Care Act part of the speech was kind of partisan. You know, Republicans were cheering it. Democrats obviously are unhappy with what they consider the sabotaging of the Affordable Care Act. You heard Elizabeth Guzman actually directly talk about this in the Spanish language response to the State of the Union last night. Now, she's a newly elected member of the House of Delegates here in Richmond. And she was elected on the platform of expanding Medicaid. So despite the fact that President Trump has repealed the individual mandate, he's cut off the cost-sharing reductions, it really is, you know, from the perspective of the Democrats sabotaging the Affordable Care Act. Despite all this, lawmakers here in Richmond are poised to expand Medicaid to 400,000 people who currently live in poverty or with disabilities.
Oh, it's an interesting perspective from Richmond. Every time the private part of the Affordable Care Act gets attacked, and it does in many places, you see in state after state, in many states, people turning around to expand the Medicaid provision. It's remarkable, Michael, that in a lot of ways, Medicaid itself quietly has won this debate within Obamacare. A lot of people haven't noticed, but it is remarkable. Gene Guerrero, I want to return to you on the question of immigration because the president gave so much attention to it last night. There is potentially a deal in the works. Nobody knows if one's going to be achieved. But as I mentioned, a fix for DACA has to come by March. The president wants money for his wall. The president wants money for border security. And the president wants a crackdown on family migration, what he and conservatives call chain migration. But I want to play you one statement from the president's remarks on immigration last night, even after he talked about providing a pathway to citizenship for 1.8 million undocumented immigrants. Listen.
My duty and the sacred duty of every elected official in this chamber is to defend Americans, to protect their safety, their families, their communities, and their right to the American dream. Because Americans are dreamers too.
Gene, Americans are dreamers too. And if you were watching social media after that remark, a lot of people took that as sort of a version of All Lives Matter in the wake of a protest, that all people are dreamers, not just the dreamers. How do people in your area take that?
Right, exactly. So a lot of the dreamers who I spoke with took offense with that comment precisely because it made it seem as though dreamers are not Americans. I mean, if Americans are dreamers too, then the dreamers are coming away with it with the interpretation that they themselves are not considered Americans. So they, again, a lot of the people who were listening to his remarks on immigration felt that they were very divisive. Although one of the subjects that is kind of like the most divisive is the wall, because of the fact that the failure in Congress to come up with an agreement so far to protect the Dreamers is basically because of the strong disagreement on the border wall and the funding for the border wall. So a lot of people were hoping that potentially he would kind of scale back his demands for that wall, but he once again was saying that he wants a great wall along the southern border, that it's essential for securing the border, and that was definitely a concern among a lot of the people who I spoke with here along the border.
Perhaps a reassurance to the president's conservative base that he's still with them, even as Congress might pursue a deal on immigration. After the State of the Union, voices from all across the country, Gene Guerrero, Adrian Ma, Michael Pope from California, from Ohio, and from the Commonwealth of Virginia. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
And we're hearing from you. What's the state of your union?
Hi, my name is Ari. I'm calling from Miami, Florida. The State of the Union is great right now. I'm very happy because I voted for Trump because of his Israel outlook and policy and his Middle East policy. And I think he's done a great job with that and has come through with the promises.
This is Marla Platt from Sudbury, Massachusetts. My union feels like it has become morally unmoored. That's because our federal legislators have lost their way, emphasizing party before people, losing track of what creates a fair and open society that allows opportunity and development for all law-abiding people within its borders.
This is Kelly from Wayzata. In the state of my union right now, we're up in the air, fearful, very uncertain, also angry at the treatment of our dreamers.
Hi, my name is Billy Taylor, and I'm calling from Greenville, South Carolina. The state of my union is one of a renewed spirit to speak truth to power, to hold elected officials and crooked cops accountable.
Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We go now to Puerto Rico, where the Federal Emergency Management Agency says today is the last day for its emergency deliveries of food and water for the people of the island. It's been 133 days since Hurricane Maria hit. FEMA officials say supermarkets are now reopened and people have access to goods. Overall, FEMA's provided more than 30 million gallons of drinking water and 60 million meals to the island since that hurricane struck. But an estimated 1 million people are still without power in Puerto Rico. Nearly 120,000 don't have access to clean water. And on Tuesday, the Puerto Rican government signaled it was unprepared for this decision from FEMA. Juan Justi Cordero is a professor of Caribbean history at the University of Puerto Rico, San Piedras. He's in San Juan.
The basic framework is the lack of power still in a large part of the island. I mean, that's the kind of the starting point for any kind of policy discussion right now, and it's about 30%. It was supposed to be a lot less than that in terms of people still not having power. It was supposed to be around 5%, and it's still around 30%. So that has many implications in terms of what people's needs are right now. That's the ongoing permanent topic of discussion here. You turn on the radio and it's people calling in. My area doesn't have electricity. There's still areas of San Juan that don't have electricity. A lot of adjacent municipalities that are part of the San Juan metropolitan area are 50% without electricity. And a lot of pockets inside San Juan that are just unexplainable. So it's a very complex situation still with electricity. And some of the government agencies, federal and Puerto Rican, seem to live in another world, really.
So to the extent that Puerto Rico is still short on clean water in some places, maybe food distribution in other places, Professor, you're saying that the lack of power is really the source of all of it at this point.
Everything depends on it. Everything depends on it. Where people don't have power, they don't have refrigerator, they have problems in storage of food, they have to spend money on gas and then mountain roads going to get food at a market. Or if they have to spend money on a power plant, that's less money that they have on hand. Just in terms of the family budgets, it's a huge problem. There's still also some water plants that are not functioning. So that also hurts the water supply in parts of the island. The distribution of water still remains an important area of relief, even more than food. You often hear people say that it's even their biggest need is in many areas is still water, even more than food.
So then what do we know about FEMA's decision to end food aid and water aid now? They say commercial providers are in good enough shape for the things that FEMA provides, that FEMA is essentially now redundant. Is that their argument?
Well, even it's like it's harmful, you know, it's hurting the market economy because according to the FEMA chief in Puerto Rico, to the extent that FEMA distributes free water and food, that's less money that people are spending in commerce, and that's less money that's going into the Puerto Rican economy. That's one of the most amazing arguments I have heard. Really, it's kind of otherworldly. It's a neoliberal argument, I guess. The market economy is always right, and anything that interferes, even emergency relief, is going to be frowned upon. Really kind of a continuation of older arguments about relief being taken advantage of by people who aren't really needy. Well, now we're hearing like a new version of that old argument. It was also a surprising announcement. It just came out of the blue. This was not a deadline that had been announced by FEMA. It took even the Puerto Rican government by surprise.
We reached out to FEMA for a comment on this issue, and here's what they told us. They said, the commercial supply chain for food and water is reestablished and private suppliers are sufficiently available that FEMA-provided commodities are no longer needed for emergency operations. FEMA will continue to support the government of Puerto Rico's needs as they are identified.
The most stunning remark by the FEMA director, Alejandro de la Campa, in Puerto Rico, the FEMA's director in Puerto Rico, was he said, the reality is that we just need to look around. Supermarkets are open and things are going back to normal. Is that their research? And where did they look around? San Juan, the metropolitan areas, some of the larger cities. If they go to Bayamón, which is just outside San Juan and it's part of the metropolitan area, the mayor was just on the radio yesterday this morning. They have half of the population in Bayamón still without electricity. And that's part of the San Juan metropolitan area. The mayor is going out. Beginning today, he said he was tired of trying to get the island government to move. And he's going out today to set up utility poles, set up cables and stuff. And with municipal employees, with former power authority employees who are retired. And they just got tired of trying to coordinate a kind of municipal effort with the island government. And they're just going out on his own. And he's part of the party in power. And he's just going out on his own. Because he says, I have half of my municipality still without electricity, and that's part of the San Juan metropolitan area.
Well, it sounds like FEMA, in your view, Professor, has not communicated effectively with the island government there. The Army Corps of Engineers is still on hand. At this point in disaster recovery, these many months later, and everything the island has been through, how would you describe Puerto Ricans' relationship with the federal government at this point?
Puerto Rico was not one of the stories that President Trump chose to bring up last night, just a brief mention. I don't think that they would have Puerto Rico on such a plane of as part of us. And it's clearer every day that the U.S. does not regard Puerto Rico as an integral part of the country, as many Puerto Ricans don't regard the U.S. as integral to us either. Here, many people, many in kind of mainstream figures, press and so forth, feel that the U.S. no longer cares for Puerto Rico, no longer needs Puerto Rico for defense purposes, as used to be the case, or for public relations, or as a profit source, as a tax shelter and so forth. That's all gone, you know, out the window. So we're just on our own.
Juan Justi Cordero, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Juan Justi Cordero is a professor of Caribbean history at the University of Puerto Rico, Rio Piedras. To Washington now, where as President Trump delivered his State of the Union speech last night, a lot of lawmakers in the audience were thinking about Russia. And that's because on Tuesday, the Trump administration said it would not impose new sanctions on Russia right now in response to Russia's election meddling. Now, that shocked a lot of lawmakers because they overwhelmingly approved sanctions in July. And it was a message then that the president was going easy on Russia and that Congress was tired of it. Meanwhile, that announcement on no sanctions now against Russia came from the State Department, just as CIA Director Mike Pompeo said there's reason to expect more Russian interference in this year's midterms. Alana Shore has been following all of this. She's a congressional reporter for Politico.
Well, the bill included this deadline for the administration to decide on sanctions. It said, come 180 days, you've got to make this call, start imposing sanctions, delay, or waive them outright. And members of both parties really wanted action. They designed this bill as a response to Russian election meddling in 2016. But what happened come the Monday cutoff was the administration said, no, thank you. No sanctions at this time. The bill itself is serving as a deterrent.
So what do these sanctions do exactly?
Well, there are several layers of sanctions built into this bill. But the one where Monday was a critical deadline were sanctions in terms of entities that do business with Russia's defense and intelligence sectors. Now, that's non-Russian entities, foreign nations, foreign companies that conduct important arms and cyber deals with the Russian elements that are believed to be closely linked to election meddling. So the idea was there would be a list of these entities in line for sanctions coming out in October. That list was almost a month late, and then they'd be in line for sanctions.
But look, Alana, back in July, when these sanctions passed, at the time, even Republicans were saying behind the scenes, Bob Corker, other people, that these sanctions signified a message to the White House, to President Trump, that he wasn't taking Russian meddling and Russian interference seriously enough. He got backed into signing it. Congress thought that they had won and had forced the president to publicly take Russia seriously. How's it being perceived now that the White House is delaying and saying, no, we don't really need to do this?
Well, Democrats are aghast. I mean, I wouldn't say they're surprised, because Democrats have been convinced pretty much since this president took office that he's just too friendly towards Russia. There's something up. But this is one more piece of evidence for them. And they're pretty livid. Republicans, on the other hand, are more inclined to believe, say, Treasury Secretary Mnuchin, who came to the Hill yesterday and said, oh, no, no, we're going to put sanctions on Russian oligarchs on a list that my department produced. It just takes some time. This was a deadline to say something. We can impose sanctions this week, next week, the week after, and we will. That was basically Mnuchin's message, and Republicans believe him.
Still, Alana, Russia hasn't been altogether thrilled this week. They don't have sanctions, but they had a couple of embarrassments nonetheless.
Absolutely. What's really an irritant to Russia, at least according to state-owned media and other folks who track the reaction there, is this list of oligarchs. Now, what that means in practice is lawmakers who wrote this bill, they wanted to name and shame officials and allies of Vladimir Putin for being closely tied to this election meddling campaign. So they required Mnuchin's department, Treasury, to produce a list of senior political figures and oligarchs. Now, Russia has been furious with this list publicly for weeks. But when the list came out, the Treasury Department acknowledged that at least the unclassified version was pretty much copied from Forbes magazine's list of richest Russians.
I'm sorry. Say that again. Treasury Department's official list of Russian oligarchs was copied and pasted from Forbes?
Yes, and I should say, credit to BuzzFeed for breaking this, but I was able to confirm it for us at Politico. You know, the department's official line is, yes, it was used from Forbes data and other sources, but the truth is it corresponds exactly with the Forbes list. To be clear, though, Treasury says this is the unclassified version of the list, and we can't discuss the classified one. But the unclassified one is all the general public has.
All right, Alana Shore, we're going to let you run. People may have noticed with all of the controversy and debate over Russian meddling in the election, Russian interference in the Russia investigation, the president of the United States didn't mention it once in his long speech last night.
Absolutely. And that left some Democrats who talked to me afterwards raising their eyebrows and scratching their heads yet again. It's becoming a frequent routine for them.
Alana Shore, congressional reporter for Politico. Alana, thanks so much.
Thank you.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, and we go to Yemen now, where secessionist fighters in southern Yemen have taken over the government's de facto capital of Aden. This comes after renewed and intense fighting in the area. Since Sunday, at least 35 people have been killed, with over 180 wounded. It's another complication in an already very complex war. With more on the latest from Yemen is Iona Craig, investigative journalist who's been covering the war there. Iona, what's the latest from Aden?
Well, the latest at the moment is that the fighting has paused. There appears to be negotiations going on now between the Southern Separatists, the Southern Transitional Council, as they're known as, who are backed by the UAE. So the UAE also involved in those negotiations, and representatives of the Hadi government. Now, of course, if those negotiations should fail, then I think it's very likely that there would be renewed fighting in Aden. But at the moment, everything is kind of hanging in the balance, really, as people await news of what happens as a result of these talks between the fighting factions that have caused so many casualties across the city over the last few days.
You mentioned these southern separatists backed by the United Arab Emirates. Who are these fighters, and what is it that they want?
Well, the Southern Secessionists have existed in Yemen for many years. This goes back really to 1990 and unification. Yemen was two separate states before then. There was then a civil war in 1994 between the north and the south. The south was quickly crushed by the northern government of Ali Abdullah Saleh, then president of Yemen. But the southern movement was then created as a political movement back in 2007, with renewed calls for secession or at least some form of autonomy from the north. So really, this is almost a recycling of history. The southerners and the separatists were crucial to the fighting in Aden back in 2015 when the city was liberated. They were the main fighting forces on the ground and were then backed by the UAE. And the UAE has continued to support them. But the southerners, the separatists, do have their own political cause. And they're taking now this opportunity to call for the removal of Hadi's government while stopping short of calling for the resignation of President Hadi himself.
You mentioned that President Hadi is already living in Riyadh in Saudi Arabia. Negotiations are underway, as you mentioned, Iona, in Aden. But if the Hadi government does wind up leaving, it raises an important question. Who's in charge?
Exactly. And it also raises serious questions about the so-called legitimate government. The international community refers to Hadi and his government as the legitimate government of Yemen. But they were kicked out of Sana'a and northern Yemen and then Aden by the Houthis back in 2015. And if they're then kicked out again in the space of 3 years, but by the southerners, it makes Hadi's position look increasingly weak now in Yemen, especially as he has spent most of his time in Riyadh over the last 3 years. And his prime minister is now surrounded and holed up in the presidential compound in Aden until ultimately the Southern Transitional Council and the UAE get their way.
Iona, we're talking about some of the politics and some of the factions on the ground in this long war in Yemen. We should remind people of the awful famine and the awful starvation and hunger going on amongst civilians in that country.
Exactly. And I think this is the bigger concern about what is happening now in Aden with these events. If negotiations don't work, if the Hadi government decides to push back militarily and fighting ensues, this is only going to make that situation a lot worse. There's now more than 22 million people out of a population of 27 million in need of humanitarian aid. The starvation situation is spreading and is getting worse. In every visit I've been back to Yemen over the last 3 years, you can see the situation for families across the country, whether they be in Houthi territory or coalition territory, is really getting very desperate. So any kind of escalation in the conflict or any kind of spread of fighting in the south, in Aden, in this current situation, is only going to make that worse for the civilian population.
Iona Craig, thanks for coming back and joining us.
Always a pleasure.
The president is under investigation by an independent prosecutor. There's possible obstruction of justice afoot. The country is divided along political and cultural lines. Meanwhile, the president is firing or threatening to fire the very people in charge of enforcing the law he's sworn to uphold. That might as well be news from 45 minutes ago, right? But it's actually news from 45 years ago, Watergate, 1973, and the parallels have not been lost on Washington as those who lived through Watergate take to the airwaves and to print, reminding everyone that as they watch this Trump White House, They've seen some of this movie before. And the parallels aren't lost on Leon Nafok either. Leon is a reporter for Slate, and he's host of Slate's Watergate podcast called Slow Burn. The series portrays the scandals around the Nixon White House in ways that immediately remind you of the news you've been hearing every day.
So to me, the biggest sort of similarity, the broadest similarity, is that you just had such chaos in the White House and such a siege mentality within the White House staff, where you had a country that was sort of being led by a gang of total paranoiacs and schemers that left a lot of unknowns for the American people. No one knew what was going to happen next. You know, you had not only a special prosecutor in both cases and an accusation of election tampering, so to speak, in both cases, but you just had a general feeling like, how will all this resolve itself? Will we survive this? And I think that's the biggest link between then and now.
Talk about Capitol Hill, 1972-1973. The parties were not nearly as divided as they are now, but there were still a lot of lawmakers with a lot invested in Richard Nixon. And the way they reacted to the unfolding scandal tells us a lot about today.
That's right. In 1972, after the break-in in June, you had crickets for quite a long time. Nixon was reelected in a major landslide in November. Between June and November, you know, the reporters who were working on the story at the Washington Post and elsewhere had a real hard time, I think, getting people to appreciate the scale of what they were uncovering, partly because they didn't realize the scale themselves necessarily. But during those first few months of the scandal, the Nixon White House was quite successful at convincing people that this was just a third-rate burglary, as the White House press secretary famously said, and sort of just politics as usual, not something that Nixon should be singled out for.
Leon, does it inform in any way what we see today? Look, the Mueller investigation has not reached the same level of Watergate. We don't know if it will. But largely from members of Congress, at least those in the president's party, those who are hanging around and not retiring, lots of efforts to undermine the investigation, not wonder aloud if something really went wrong here.
Yeah, and I think you saw the same thing then. It's sort of an eternal truth, I guess, about elected officials. They have to make their decisions based on what they think will win them the next election. With Nixon, as with Trump, I think you see elected officials making a calculation, like, will it be better for me if I stand with him or if I desert him? Under Nixon, it took a very, very long time, almost until the very end, for his fellow Republicans to abandon him en masse. There were obviously exceptions. There were individuals who sounded the alarm earlier than others. But, you know, you had a large chorus of Republicans trying to play it down. I think you saw it in the National Review. You saw that among, you know, right-wing pundits who at the time, you know, there wasn't much of a conservative media infrastructure the way there is now. But what little there was pretty firmly behind Nixon.
You did an episode called True Believers, which looks at the public, the voters who might have been driving the motivations of some of the lawmakers that we're talking about. You had Gail Sheehy on, who really spoke to some of the identity politics that I think myopically we think is just a sign of our times, but was around back then as well. Let's hear a clip.
But when the bar owner put the hearings on TV and floated the idea with his regulars,
"Hey guys, you want to watch that Watergate thing?"
Their answer was unanimous.
"Turn it off!"
It wasn't just that they weren't interested. As far as the barflies at Terry's were concerned, the Senate hearings were just a big show, put on by liberals who wanted to take down the president. Why should anyone reward them by watching?
A little bit of dramatic reading by Gail Sheehy there, Leon.
Yes.
People talk about tribalism today, and that passage from your podcast from episode 5 really shows it's nothing new.
Yeah, I was quite frankly astonished to read Sheehy's piece from 1973. It was published in New York Magazine right as the Senate Watergate hearings were starting. If I didn't know that it had been published then as opposed to now, sort of with the benefit of hindsight, I would have thought, you know, oh, they're playing up these similarities between Trump voters and Nixon voters. You read her interviews with these guys and they talk about all the same stuff. You know, the Nixon was a tough guy.
And that's what the way these guys felt. They were nobodies, except that Richard Nixon gave them an identity. Richard Nixon was the tough guy who was going to get rid of all those anti-war people, all those anarchists, terrorists, the people who were tearing down our country.
Leon, change a couple of minor details in that statement, and Gail Sheehy could be talking about last week, not 1973.
Totally, and I think there was so much of the same resentments, I think, that we associate with at least part of Trump's base. And so, yeah, it sort of was a reminder to me that these are forces that can be seized in 1973 just as well as they can be seized in 2016 or 17.
Leon, people like to imagine sometimes what President Richard Nixon during the hottest heat of Watergate might have been like if he had a Twitter feed. I think you're one of the people best situated to answer that question now.
One sort of amazing contrast, I think, between Nixon and Trump is that Nixon was actually very restrained in his public appearances. I mean, one of the reasons that I think the White House tapes made such a huge impression on people is that he sounded like a completely different person in these private conversations. He maintained a pretty professional public face. You know, some of the things that were said in those tapes, Trump has said worse things publicly, and it's only the fact that they are public that makes them less explosive to me. If there was a secret tape of Trump saying what he said to Lester Holt in that NBC interview about Russia, where he said, sure, I fired him because of the Russia thing, maybe we would react to it much differently than it did when he simply just blurted it out.
Leon, the fact base is different between Watergate and the Mueller investigation in the current White House. But with all that you found out about the similarities of political culture, political messaging, tribalism, and an embattled White House through your podcast, Slow Burn, where do you think this thing is headed?
I think the regrettable conclusion I've come to is that there's nothing inevitable about Nixon's downfall that should reassure us with regard to Trump. And I'm not saying that because I think Trump resigning is automatically the thing that needs to happen or should happen. But insofar as people are listening to the show with an ear for comforting data, justice was served. You know, guy was in the White House who did things unbecoming of the office and he got what he deserved. And that's how the story goes. It's only in retrospect that we know how the story ended. What I've learned is that so many things had to go a certain way for the outcome to be what it was. That sort of happened to happen. And maybe something will happen to happen under Trump as well, but there's nothing promised about it, I think.
Leon Nafok is a reporter for Slate and host of Slate's Watergate podcast, Slow Burn. Leon, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. Oh, hi, Billie Holiday, you're here. I love when you come around every time there's a blue moon.
Blue moon, you saw me standing alone.
Of course, the moon isn't really blue. We know that. It's when there's two full moons in any single month. Wait, sorry, Billy. Sorry for the interruption. What's that? Hold on. Tonight there's also a...
There's a super moon above us. There's a super moon.
The super moon is back. It's working blue this time around. The supermoon, of course, when the full moon coincides with the closest distance in the moon's elliptical orbit around the Earth, and closer means, basically, it looks bigger. Wait, hang on, you guys. There's more?
Kissing through a lunar eclipse. Don't be bitter.
That's right. It's a very local celestial trifecta, a blue moon, a supermoon, and a total lunar eclipse. Can you feel the moonbeams? Well, don't freak out. Because at times like this, we often turn to Jason Kendall, adjunct professor of astronomy at William Paterson University. Jason, welcome.
Glad to be here.
Glad to have you here to tell us everything we need to know about this lunar craziness that we have on our hands. Jason, you don't even need a telescope for this one.
No, you don't. You don't need a telescope at all. All you got to do is go outside and look up at that moon. It's always wonderful to go out and see a lunar eclipse because it's very strange. The moon appears to be being eaten by the shadow of the Earth.
Explain, though, the rarity here. People have seen lunar eclipses and they're spectacular. There's some debate over the supermoon. By the way, we're going to get to that. Blue moons do happen once every in a blue moon. Yeah. But all three together, how rare?
It's pretty rare. The next one that'll happen in the United States is about 2028. If you consider only the continental U.S., then you'd have to go back 150 years in order to see when this was last seen in the U.S. But lunar eclipses themselves are relatively common. They happen very frequently, so we shouldn't. But it's not a really big deal for a lunar eclipse. But that doesn't mean they're not pretty and not wonderful and not worth going outside and seeing.
Is the lunar eclipse more spectacular, more remarkable from a viewing perspective, because the moon is that much larger in the supermoon phase when it's closest to the Earth?
Well, it's only about 10% larger in angular diameter, meaning you can think about the way to think about the size of the moon is if you take your thumb at arm's length and look at it with one eye, that the moon is always about half the width of your thumb held at arm's length. And that works for pretty much everybody and every thumb. So it never gets much bigger than half that length. And so it's hard to actually perceive the difference in angular size as it goes. But that doesn't mean it doesn't do anything. The fun part about it is just simply that it gets this blood red, and that's due to the refracted light of the sun going through the Earth's atmosphere.
That's the blood moon you're talking
about.
That's
the blood moon.
Spectacular.
Yeah.
Look, Jason, Neil deGrasse Tyson, America's favorite astronomer, astrophysicist, friend of the Takeaway, been on lots of times. I know you're ready for this. Supermoon talk, Neil deGrasse Tyson is not feeling it. Listen.
Okay, first, I got to nip this in the bud. Okay. Don't get me started. So there's something called a supermoon.
Okay.
I don't know who first called it a supermoon.
All right.
I don't know. But if you have a 16-inch pizza, would you call that a super pizza compared with a 15-inch pizza? It's a slightly bigger moon. I ain't using the adjective supermoon.
Jason Kendall, Neil deGrasse Tyson is all over social media at times like this saying, we reserve the word super for lots of things that truly are super. This is not one of them in his view.
Well, that's perfectly fine. If we wish to give it its proper title, it's a perigean full moon, meaning it's a full moon at perigee. But supermoon was coined not in the last few years by someone who was actually not an astronomer. And what happened was closer than 90% of the time. And that allows for a lot of supermoons. So I kind of like supermoon because it gets people outside and going up and looking. And it doesn't really have an astronomical or a research level thing that's important for it. But it certainly has something that says, wow, this is neat. Go on outside. Take a look. And that's
lunar eclipses can take place over more than one night in the full phase. I think that viewers in the western part of the United States, moon viewers, might have seen a lunar eclipse this morning. The rest of us might have missed it already.
That's correct. The lunar eclipse was the moon during the lunar eclipse was just entering the shadow of the Earth, the umbral shadow, the darkest part of the shadow, just as the moon was setting in New York. But way out in California, they got a chance to see the entire thing. So pretty much if you were in the Pacific, you got to see it. And people on the western rim of the Pacific will get to see the moon rising throughout the lunar eclipse. So the lunar eclipse itself lasts no more than an hour or so as the moon takes its time to go through the shadow.
And Jason, what's best here, a good pair of binoculars?
That's a wonderful thing. But I actually saw it on the deck of a cruise ship in 2011, and I just looked up, and that was fantastic because it's neat to just see the moon having this sliver, this circular chunk being taken away from it as it moves. So, yeah, binoculars are very, very interesting to use. People actually want to know the brightness of the moon. So sometimes when that's actually a real research thing. If you look at the brightness of the moon as it's in a lunar eclipse, what you end up getting is measuring the total amount of particulates in the atmosphere, say to do volcanoes or something, and that shows the albedo of the Earth, and that can help for climate studies.
Well, Jason, let's take a minute. We got to run, but let's talk about policy for just a second. President Trump didn't mention it in his speech last night, but he has talked about returning the United States to the moon, manned missions. In preparations for that eventual trip to Mars, what does that mean for U.S. space exploration? Are you a supporter?
I'm a complete supporter of returning humanity, not just the United States, humanity to the moon, and taking the huge step to Mars. This thing would actually be an incredible boon for the economy because the money doesn't go to the moon or to Mars. It goes into high technology jobs. It goes into manufacturing. It goes into, you know, people who buy T-shirts next to Kennedy Space Center, you know, everything. So this would be a huge boost for the economy in the way that an infrastructure bill would as well. But I just think it's cool because then – what's funny is all my students at William Patterson, they find this to be really dreamy that if they can go to the moon. They say, wow, I really want to do that. They think of themselves. The younger people say, wow, I want to do this. And that's neat. So I just think it's like if we can do it, then if we can build those rockets, they will go. It's as simple as that.
we can build those rockets because we've built them before. Mm-hmm. Jason Kendall, I appreciate you stopping by to help us through the lunar trifecta. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Jason Kendall, adjunct professor of astronomy at William Patterson University. Well, we've been hearing from you about this moon age daydream.
Hi, this is Nathan from Oklahoma. I was just thinking we really should have a simpler name for it. And though I know the blue has no actual bearing on the color, my thought is blue and red make purple, which to me has always seemed like a majestic color. So maybe a royal moon? Let me know what you think, guys.
A royal purple moon. Nathan, I like it. I think it's perfect for this divided country. Everybody can look up whether they're red or blue, see the royal purple moon. I love it. Do you have a name for this blood blue red purple moon? Let us know, 8778MYTAKE. You can always tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering storage solutions for business, including file folders, banker's boxes, and storage bins for getting organized. More at Staples stores or staples.com. Staples, it's pro time. And by Progressive Insurance, providing tools designed to help customers consider options from multiple insurers. Comparisons available at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Now that's progressive.
PRI, Public Radio International.